You're listening to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow. This is a wild Clearwater country. It's 4:05. We're starting a little bit late today, but that's all right.
Just fine today. So I have to run down and do a little visit.
Yeah.
Ribs are broken from my bicycle encounter with the pavement here the other day. So,
we've got some quick announcements.
Oh, yeah.
Let's start off with in case you're carrying on listening to Words of Music Show with Nancy Casey and continuing to listen to KRFP Community Radio here in Moscow, there's a potluck, kind of a joint potluck, gathering of some folks next week, the 29th, believe it is, yeah. Tuesday night, 6:30.
Friends of the Clearwater.
Yeah, Friends of the Clearwater.
Folks from Haiti.
Yeah.
One you probably heard on the radio.
Yeah.
Abnen, Afelon.
That's right. Gary, you've got that nice accent down, man. I feel a little bit shorthanded here.
Well,
I'm not in the world of bilingualism.
And next Wednesday, we're going to have them on the show for a little bit.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about forests in Haiti.
That's right.
And I will try to translate.
And they're going to be sharing with us at the potluck the reasons they're here, and which include wanting to know more about ecological damage, especially deforestation here. And because
Some parallels,
that's right.
Happens everywhere, doesn't it?
Yeah,
boy.
It means
everywhere there's forests.
That's right, and it's very connected to the immediate quality of life where they live.
Absolutely.
And so that's going to be 6:30 next Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be at my house, actually.
She will.
All
that's right.
116 North Howard.
So that's anybody can come to that.
Yeah.
Another quick announcement, if anybody's rather interesting on one. Anybody's been following the paper lately about this famous or infamous, I should say, school fire salvage sale on the Umatilla National Forest. A little bit out of the wild Clearwater country, but kind of interest since it's very close to Moscow. They only got low bids on two sales, and one, the Ollie sale didn't even sell. And I believe Ollie was, I think that was the one on the west side of the Toucan River, but I'll have to go check. So really interesting. They were trying to do a rush job through the process, and guess what? There's not that much interest in this, and so the government didn't get that much money anyway. Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Another quick announcement, and I'm going to let you take over, Will, and I'm going to step out
here.
The National Environmental Policy Act, the federal government, the Council on Environmental Quality, oversees it for all agencies, including the U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, etc., Fish and Wildlife Service, the whole bunch of them, is revising the regulations or thinking about it so people can send in some comments by September 1st. There'll be more information on this show. I think we'll talk a little bit about that in the weeks to come, probably next week while we speak with Abner and Afelon. So anyway, that's very interesting information, and I'm going to step out.
Get out of here.
Head down the road.
Yeah, hopefully you will start to feel better soon, Gary. And one more announcement, too. There's a public town hall meeting tonight at the University Inn, Best Western, Silver Room, from 7 to 8 p.m., probably go past 8. I have a feeling some people are going to show up to voice their concerns, speak their minds about issues that are important to them. Senator Larry Craig will be here taking public comment at this town hall meeting. It's a good opportunity to express your concerns about anything you want. And I think this is really the kind of the foundation of democracy here. I'm a bit cynical myself and growing more so by the day, but I still think that this is a great opportunity. And I think you can't pass, just like you can't pass up the ballot box, you really should head on down there to the Best Western at 7. It doesn't matter what you have concerns about or want to ask questions about. I don't know how much the senator will be commenting back. Probably not too much, because I have a feeling there will be a long line. I know a lot of the concerns that I have are naturally ecological in nature, specifically this tendency for compromised wilderness bills to show up in the Senate and in the House, specifically CEDRA, Central Idaho Economic Development and Recreation Act. That's a concern that I have, that wilderness bills are no longer crafted to protect certain areas, but they have become more like stockholder association meetings or stakeholder association meetings, where everyone who has any kind of thought or concern about public lands is invited, and a gigantic deal is formed to try to meet all special interest desires. I don't think that's a good way to do things. I think wilderness bills should come out of a concern for an area that might provide clean water, clean air for nearby communities, provide wildlife and fish for communities, and also that have inherent value in and of themselves for biodiversity reasons and for a place of solitude for those who like to recreate themselves in visiting those places. So please go to the University in Best Western tonight, 7 p.m. I won't say it. Well, I'll probably say it again. Very important. Okay, we're going to do a quick weather break here. We're going to get into a little music, and then we'll be back to talk a little bit about some lesser-known species of the Clearwater. We're going to be talking about Potlatch Corporation, and we're going to be listening to some good music. Thanks for joining us. Weather for the Palouse, currently 78 degrees, humidity 24%. There is a weather advisory right now issued by Idaho DEQ for Lewiston because of fine particulate matter in the air caused by burning local forest fires. There is a burn ban in effect for that area, too. I have a feeling that Potlatch Corporation has contributed some particulate matter, maybe smaller in nature than the particulate matter they mean today, but we all know what comes out of that mill. This is the Gypsy Kings. Thank you. Welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country, and that's the Gypsy Kings. It's nice. Well, it's kind of a hazy day today in Moscow. And one of those groups of species you don't think about as much in the West, at least I've noticed. Those species that need a little milder climate, milder in temperature, milder in humidity. If you think of the middle as mild in humidity, or at least tending toward to be a little more humid, amphibians in Idaho, not the most common of creatures. 10 species of frogs and toads in the state. 4 salamander species in the state, one of which we talk about a lot, Coeur d'Alene salamander. Idaho giants are up here too. Long-toed salamanders are up here too. This, just to do a little comparison for you, to a state a little bit south and east of here, North Carolina, has nearly 50 salamander species and nearly 30 species of frogs and toads. A lot more humid and a lot less cold there for the most part. And if you look at the state of Idaho, as you move north to south, as most of you know, it gets a little bit drier. And so the salamanders tend to fade out a little bit more as you move south. So we're kind of in the spot for amphibian diversity in the state here in the Wild Clearwater Country. And lots of research has been done, and most of the results are showing that the Clearwater really may be the source for amphibian biodiversity, especially the Coeur d'Alene salamander. It's thought from some recent studies done by Jack Sullivan at the U of I, tested a few hypotheses concerning the evolutionary history of the species and where it may have originated, and a little look at the genetic diversity to uncover some of those mysteries, revealed that there seemed to be a wealth of diversity in the Clearwater region, and also there tended to be a pretty well-defined difference in genetic makeup between river systems. The current thought, geologically speaking, is that the Clearwater Basin escaped glaciation, the last glaciation, which came down around the St. Joe area, didn't come quite this far south. And so because glaciation didn't come this far south, and because those long, deep canyons of the Clearwater Country are the end point for weather systems moving west to east, they get much more precipitation than, say, at the confluence of the Clearwater and the Snake River down there in Clarkston. So the Clearwater has been a moist and mild climate kind of place, a great place for salamanders, a great place for frogs, and I've seen a little bit of each there with some other folks, some Idaho giants, some Coeur d'Alene salamanders, and western or boreal toads. And boreal toad is the one species we're going to focus on today. Boreal toad being a distinct subspecies of the western toad found a little bit further north. And if you follow conservation issues and are interested in disease, boreal toads have been hit pretty hard by a chitid fungus recently, also an iridiovirus. But the chitid fungus seems to really taken its toll, especially on the southern Rockies population of boreal toad in the state of Colorado specifically. And what happens is these toads, they get this fungus and they have skin abnormalities. They become weak and lethargic, and so therefore don't flee from danger, higher mortality rate, and roadkill being one of those that happens quite often. So a couple of major characteristics for boreal toads. If you ever look into the eye of a toad, it's kind of eerie. They have horizontal pupils. they have eyes that don't extend to the margin of their head. Two specific things about boreal toads. They have two horny tubercles on their hind feet. And if you're familiar with spadefoot toads, it kind of reaches its peak in grotesqueness in spadefoots. But the reason those tubercles are there are so when mating season comes around, the toads have some grips to hold on to. They call frog and toad courtship or mating amplexus. And so when the male and female are in amplexus, the male locks on to the female by wrapping his feet around those two horny tubercles. The western toads, if you're familiar with other toads, is about the same size as a Woodhouse's toad, which is a common western species. And they're get up to about 5 inches long. Females are generally larger, and that's the trend. That's the way it works in the toad and frog world for the most part. And they're found throughout the state of Idaho. Pretty tolerant species, generally. And like your regular toads, they are covered in warts and are typically dry, but the ones I've seen have been in pretty wet regions, and so we're a little bit damp themselves. They feed on larvae. They feed on plant material, on bottom detritus, all that nice, rich, mucky stuff at the bottom of a pond or bottom of a puddle or a little marsh. They eat all kinds of flying insects, spiders, crayfish, those nice pill bugs, and even earthworms. They burrow in loose soil or sometimes use the burrows of small mammals. At lower elevations, the frogs are mainly diurnal, active in the daytime, in late winter and spring, and nocturnal in summer. In mountain populations, they tend to be active day and night depending on conditions. And hibernation does occur in winter in cold climates. Birds and garter snakes prey on adults. And this is kind of a fascinating tidbit. Predatory insect larvae feed on the young tadpoles. That's the western arboreal toad. Very interesting species, and one found in the wild Clearwater country, one of a little bit of conservation concern right now because we don't know. And some of these kind of threats, biological threats, are often the most difficult to cope with. You don't have to necessarily feel the guilt for the loss of some of these frogs because of man-caused disruption, like habitat destruction, which I'm sure has played at least a small factor in most species' population levels and distribution. This is a little more elusive and harder to figure out what to do to stop this from happening. Similar viruses and fungus affect all kinds of native species in Pacific dogwood and some other species I know of as well. Eastern hemlock and also flowering dogwood in the east. Also species affected by viruses and fungus, and are harder to get a handle on what to do, how to stop that from happening. So, but there is information out there, and if you check out the Panhandle Forest website, they have a pretty decent wildlife website, and you click on Wildlife of the IPF, and you can read a little bit about some of the different species there, including the boreal toad. Well, we're going to get into a little more music here. Some Johnny Hahn, and then we're going to get back into some Gypsy Kings, and then we're going to keep talking about the importance of this town hall meeting tonight, 7 p.m., Best Western University in Moscow. Senator Larry Craig will be here, and eager to hear what we have to say, hopefully receptive to some of the things he hears, and we hope to see you all there. You're listening to KRFP Radio Free Moscow. That's Johnny Hahn on piano from Pike Place Market. All right. We'll be listening to some more hymn. It's 4:33. You're listening to KRFP Radio Free Moscow. It's a wild Clearwater country. And there will be a public meeting tonight. The Best Western University in Silver Room, 7 p.m. There will also be this Sunday at Swallows Park in Clarkston. There is going to be a public gathering. A guy has been paddling. He's going to paddle a total of 900 miles on the Columbia River system. He's been paddling and he's going to reach Clarkston Sunday. Been paddling the salmon. And so there's going to be some folks there to greet him. And I think what folks hope is that this sheds some light on Snake River dams and the need for those dams to go away for a variety of reasons. But most importantly, for the return of the salmon, Chinook, steelhead, who knows, maybe even sockeye. That's Sunday at Swallows Park in Clarkston. Contact Idaho Rivers United or Save Our Wild Salmon for more information. Well, there's something happening down there in the valley, down at the Potlatch Mill, that recently came to our attention. Potlatch Corporation has applied for a permit to burn a whole bunch of things that really should not be burned. By any stretch of the imagination. One thing you always hear, at least I remember just knowing inherently that automobile tires were not supposed to be burned, and tire fires were very, very dangerous, hazardous things that occasionally happened. But to request to burn, what do they titled it this nice acronym, tire-derived fuel, TDF is what they called it in their report. They want to burn a whole bunch of shredded tires, plastic packaging, turpentine. They do burn turpentine already. They want to raise the cap from 3,500 gallons a month to 15,000 gallons, or preferably just make the ceiling unlimited. They want to burn treated lumber, creosote treated railroad ties, carpet waste. They want to burn a lot of stuff that shouldn't be burned in that number 4 boiler. And where is all that particulate matter and pollutants? They're going up river. They're staying in the Clearwater airshed. And they're causing major air quality concerns up river of the mill. And this can have long-term ecological effects and effects on the communities up river as well. The pollutants from these burns, I don't have a lot of information about the pollutants, but dioxins, PHBs, increased sulfur dioxide emissions, all of these things would be increased greatly. And the Pilots Corporation is actually asking for permission to burn hundreds of thousands of tons of what they've called refuse-derived fuel. And that includes a lot of the things that I've already mentioned. And what are the alternatives? Why would they want to do this? Well, they claim rising energy costs are forcing them to do this, and they just can't hang with the almighty barrel of oil is just causing them to go belly up. What they could do, and they acknowledge this in the report, is sell these byproducts. Some of these things they want to burn are byproducts of wood processing. Turpentine is one. Turpentine can be sold for further processing. Rather than take responsibility for the production of these byproducts and their reuse, proper reuse, selling to be further processed for another purpose rather than burning, Glycerin is another byproduct that could be sold instead of burned. They want to burn that as well. So, what can you do about this? Well, there's some information floating around. There are quite a few people interested in stopping this permit application from being granted. Quite a few people all around North Idaho are concerned about this. You can contact Safe Air for Everyone in Sandpoint. You can contact Friends of the Clearwater in Moscow. You can go and talk to Senator Larry Craig and ask him to keep industry accountable. But I would listen and look for more information, either on flyers or on the web. You can also contact Radio Free Moscow for more information about this. There is an open comment period to begin soon. The comment period that was open was not public. The Idaho DEQ had to be formally asked to open a comment period. That has happened. There will be a 30-day comment period in the near future. We'll have an announcement about that. So some time for folks to organize and get together on this issue. And I think that's what some people around here do best, is get together, work hard, cooperate, and for a positive result, as evidenced by the campaign to keep Walmart, Super Walmart, out of Moscow. It was a great victory there. Campaign to protect the Cedar Grove of Moscow Mountain. Just some examples of excellent grassroots activism at work. Well, we are going to get back into some more Gypsy Kings, and we're gonna close with a little excerpt from a book I'm currently reading. It's gotten better and better. I was a little concerned at first. It's called Scorched Earth. It's a little bit out of the wild Clearwater country, but it touches on some issues that affect us, especially this time of year, fire season. And there are some fires out there. Hell's Canyon is seeing some fires on the Idaho side now. In fact, the Seven Devils area has been closed. Another place that's popular to hike that has been closed is Kamiak Butte. It was closed the end of July because of fire danger. Some other fires still active in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness area. The Bar Creek Fire east of Pot Mountain Roadless area is still burning. The lightning fire near Riggins has been extinguished. So those are some of the major fires that you might have heard. There are quite a few others on the Clearwater and on the Nez Perce Forest and across the state, further down into the Payette, down on the Salmon River. We will have another fire update for you next week, but please check out the Grangeville Interagency Dispatch. If you're going to go hiking or backpacking, you might want to look on that site and look at the map to see where these fires are burning. Not a good situation to get too close to one of these fires. And a few roads have actually been closed, and so you might not even be able to get to where you want to get, and that would help you along your way. So please check out that website. We'll get into some more music by the Gypsy Kings, and we'll be back for more Wild Clearwater Country.
Chinela la cali, Valdivia, la cali, Valdivia.
that's more Gypsy Kings for you. Well, I was mentioning a book I'd like to read an excerpt or two from. Just read a few pages, actually, here. A book I'm reading called The Scorched Earth, How the Fires of Yellowstone Changed America, and delves into the history of fire policy pre and post 1988 when the big fires raged across Yellowstone. Burned over 1 million acres. Huh. Book is pretty new release. It's by Rocky Barker, who's a journalist for the Idaho Statesman. This is chapter 3, and just to give you a little frame here, we've been working and learning and following Philip Sheridan, general for the Union, who became interested in this area, and who actually was an amateur ornithologist and naturalist, owing to his meeting of some folks when he was first enlisted in Texas, learning to hunt, bird hunt and deer hunt. And his love for nature was born out of those hikes and those hunting trips there, and followed him and in his travels out west following the war. He came across a few folks who talked about this magical place where geysers spouted into the sky and amazingly colored waters boiled up and clay pots boiled, and this high ground of plentiful with game that was hard to get to, hard country. And so he and a fellow named Jay Cook, who is an investment banker, really, though, according to this book, the first investment banker in the U.S., pretty wealthy and ambitious guy. They both had reasons for wanting to travel this place, but they ended up on the same expedition to this place. They actually didn't attend this expedition themselves, but they had their agents, and that's where we left off as they're heading out into Yellowstone for what they call the Washburn Expedition. Now, Cook and Sheridan each had his own man riding into Yellowstone in August of 1870. With the Washburn Expedition, Nathaniel Langford was Cook's eager agent, gathering his fodder for the lectures he would use to awaken interest in the railroad bonds Cook was selling. The adventurer, Lieutenant Gustavus Doan, was finally on a quest, with orders that were born in Sheridan's Helena visit 3 months before. Sheridan and Cook were by no means rivals. Building the Northern Pacific Railroad's line westward was national policy, and as commander of all U.S. Army forces in the West, it was Sheridan's job to help it along. As Cook's survey crews worked their way across the nation, Sheridan's soldiers escorted and protected them. But the two men were soon to develop very different views about who should protect Yellowstone and from whom. Cook first envisioned Yellowstone as a grand symbol for his new railroad, a scenic marvel to attract investment in the bonds needed to finance his expansion. Today, advertising executives would call it branding. Cook also hoped he would lure rich investors to follow their investment west as tourists. He initially hoped that at least some of Yellowstone might even fall within the railroad's land grant. In Sheridan's original Helena speech in 1870, the general spoke enthusiastically of how the Northern Pacific would foster Montana's already successful development. But by the end of the 1870s, he would gradually change his tune, eventually opposing the Northern Pacific's monopoly control of the area. He would offer a competing vision, one of strong government control and press for U.S. Army protection of its wildlife and wonders. In 1870, these two agents of manifest destiny, the philosophy underlying the development of the West, were starting the wheels rolling on a national crusade to leave part of it wild. Neither could have predicted when they first learned of the geysers, hot springs and waterfalls, that spring from this land, that their curiosity would help to lead to a national shift in values. Both of their visions have been all but lost to the ages. Both have been relegated to second or third rank supporting roles, if given any role at all in Yellowstone's founding. The Washburn expedition left Helena on August 16, 1870, joining up with Lieutenant Doan and the military escort at Fort Ellis near Bozeman, Montana. The band of explorers, now ballooned to 19, rode east to the Yellowstone River and then south into what would become the park, naming rivers, waterfalls, and mountains they encountered. They rode past the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone, awed by its scenic falls. They circled Lake Yellowstone, losing Truman Everts, a revenue assessor, who was not found until he straggled out of the wilderness 37 days later. After the expedition returned, the party climbed over the Continental Divide near Shoshone Lake and camped in the Upper Geyser Basin, where they discovered and named Old Faithful because of the regularity of its eruptions. Early in the trip, they encountered a fire near Blacktail Plateau that they believed was started by American Indians. Doan wrote on August 26th, "The Great Plateau had been recently burned off to drive away the game, and the woods were still on fire in every direction." On their last night, September 19th, the party camped beneath a striking rock face of the Madison River Canyon at the junction of the Firehole and Gibbon Rivers. For most of the 20th century, the public was led to believe that the idea of a national park was invented at this juncture. The 7,500-foot peak overlooked the campsite was even named National Park Mountain in honor of the mythic campfire discussion, and the National Park Service still has a plaque at the site claiming as much. In the 1950s and 60s, the National Park Service presented annual reenactments of the event. The Hallmark Hall of Fame even broadcast a radio play depicting the explorers' campfire conversation in 1963. Roderick Nash, in his classic Environmental History, Wilderness and the American Mind, which was first published in 1967, as the new environmental age was dawning, also repeated the story as fact. As recently as 1997, Vice President Al Gore repeated the story in celebrating Yellowstone's 125th anniversary. This story has carried a great significance for generations of conservationists and environmentalists. It became a creation myth of the environmental movement. Even people who never knew the story were shaped by the myth. The campfire discussion became an allegory for environmental progress and its altruistic roots. A similar campfire discussion is credited with the preservation of the Frank Church River of No Return wilderness. The immensely popular Encounters with the Arch Druid, about the modern environmental leader David Brower, by John McPhee, uses the campfire discussion as a narrative device to discuss environmentalism. The story itself was created by Langford, who long vied for and until recent times carried the title of Yellowstone's founder. His version of the founding was included in the park's first history, the Yellowstone National Park, written in 1895 by Hiram Martin Chittenden, a U.S. Army engineer who oversaw the building of hundreds of miles of roads in the park. The story carried with it a new appreciation of nature, with all the aspirations and philosophical underpinnings laid by Thoreau and Emerson. The campfire creation of the national park idea elevated the legislative acts to follow into a morality tale, an act of fortitude exercised by a confident, maturing nation of high-minded individuals. But as National Park Service historian Aubrey Haynes demonstrated in the 1960s, the story simply isn't true. And we're going to stop there. That's kind of a nice place to stop. We're going to hear more from Philip Sheridan, Samuel Langford, and Jay Cook as they work to have their competing visions reach reality there in the Yellowstone region prior to its founding as a national park. And I just want to reiterate, public meeting tonight, town hall meeting at the University Best Western Inn, 7 p.m. And it's going to be in the Silver Room. And Senator Larry Craig will be there. It's an open comment kind of meeting. You can come and talk about any topic you wish. And I just encourage you to get out there and say a few words to the senator. very important part of our democratic society is making our voices heard. And that's the first important step, just like the ballot box. So get out there. We hope to see you there. And please stay tuned for Between the Lines. And next week, same time, Wild Clearwater Country, 4 p.m. Wednesday. Thanks for joining us.